Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks everyone for being with us again on another Sunday. We're going to talk today about constructive dialogue, political polarization. Our guest, Dr. Rachel Wall. She's an associate professor in the Department of Leadership, Foundations, and Policy at UVA School of Education and Human Development. She brings with her a doctorate from New York University and a degree from Marymount Manhattan College. Dr. Wall, thanks for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm always curious what a professor provides as a definition of a word or phrase so that I can make sure that myself and the listeners are following along, because any of us who've taken a class or seen an academic individual on television or listened on the radio sometimes find out that what we had in our head is not always the same as what the academic specialist might be trying to tell us and talk about. So can we start with, can you define constructive dialogue?
Sure. So I would say first that I don't come into this work with an idea in my head of what constructive dialogue is. My question is, what happens when people who disagree about politics try to talk to each other? What does it mean to them? What do they get out of it? And what does it mean for our democracy? So I really try to avoid assuming there is a static way to define what it is and then evaluate whether or not people succeed or fail. I'm really trying to understand what happens for people. In the conversations that I've observed and the interviews I've done with those people, it does seem that when people are able to focus on understanding rather than persuading, they're actually able to be more persuasive. People tend to put up defenses when they feel that they're being argued out of their own commitments. And when they feel that somebody is curious and exploring something with them, they tend to drop those defenses and become curious as well. So I would say that in the conversations that I've observed and the ways that I've talked to people about those conversations afterward, that orientation to understanding has made both sides seem to get more out of the conversation than not.
Has the orientation changed in the last 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? Because when reading about your work on constructive dialogue, there's a significant focus on the last 5 years. But has it just changed in this significant manner in that time frame, or does it go back further than that?
Do you mean my own research, or do you mean the nature of our political landscape?
Well, can we do both, maybe a little bit separately?
Sure. So in terms of the focus of my research, I actually started out researching the way police officers respond to community activism and education around police violence. And my first book was on the way police officers in India respond to human rights activism and education. And when I came back to the United States after writing that book on India, that was when there was widespread attention to police violence against unarmed people of color in the United States. And I became interested in how police were responding to that kind of activism, those kinds of community efforts. So when I got back to Charlottesville, I tried to find out what was happening here in regard to human rights work with police, and learned that there were a series of community dialogues being organized between police officers and community members. And so then I became interested in what happened in these conversations and what was the meaning for the community members involved, what was the meaning for the police officers involved. And then that sparked a broader interest in what happens for anybody in these kinds of structured conversations. Why do we want to talk to each other? Why do we want to talk to people who have vastly different conceptions of justice than we do? What is it that we get out of it? And what are the risks of these conversations? Who might be harmed in them and how? So the timing of it was that I came to it in a kind of unusual way. And in terms of anything changing, you know, I think there's been so much said and written about increasing polarization in the United States. And I agree with assessments that the problem is not necessarily polarization in itself, that there are issues that warrant deeply committed views. You know, I don't think many of us would not want to go back to a consensus around, you know, the acceptability of certain forms of racism. Even though we would be less polarized, we wouldn't want that kind of consensus if it's a consensus around injustice. So I do think that the conversation has gotten more polarized, but that may be because there are more perspectives and voices included in it.
So what is the point of even trying to have these conversations if we have become such a deeply polarized society?
Yeah, that was my question. That was why I wanted to do this research. Why? Why do we want to have these conversations? Why do we want to have them with our family members? Why do we want to have them with strangers? And so what I started doing was observing structured dialogue sessions that were created for university students. And these sessions brought together university students on the political right and the political left, liberals and conservatives, and put them together to talk about the issues that divide them. So I observed these sessions, and then I interviewed the students afterward. I interviewed over 50 students and then interviewed many of them again years after their first dialogue sessions to see what had stayed with them. And first, what I found is that some of what people worry about in these conversations didn't appear to be the case. So one thing that many people worry about is that dialogue is just going to make everything too ambiguous. It's going to actually diminish political commitment. We need people who are committed to justice. We need people who are committed to high ideals, and dialogue is just going to kind of make everything gray and mushy. But I actually did not see that happening, that if anything, people walk out of these conversations more committed, more aware of what they care about, more aware of their ideals. But what these conversations did seem to do is, in cases where it was warranted, shift the way people view those who disagree with them. And the reason I say in cases where it was warranted is because I think it's really important that dialogue isn't some kind of technology that has inevitable results. Dialogue itself doesn't do anything. It's not like we have dialogue and then we inevitably come out feeling better about the other person and finding common ground and agreeing with them. That it would be really bad, I think, if dialogue had those effects inevitably, because that would mean that it was some kind of manipulating technology that was actually really undemocratic, that was just kind of working on us, right? But it really just depends on who you talk to and what you think of them. And in cases, many cases I found, where the person you're talking to does actually have motivations that are better than you expected and ideals that are more recognizable than you expected, people tend to walk away with a really changed understanding not of the political issue, but of the people on the other side of it, where they say, wow, honestly, I thought that those people were motivated by a desire to just control society, or I thought that they were motivated by fear, or I thought that they were motivated by hate. But it turns out they actually had high ideals that are not my ideals, but I can recognize that they are ideals. And I think that that can allow people to be a little bit less quick to believe conspiracy theories about the other side, to want to disenfranchise the other side when they see that they actually are motivated by something recognizably good, even if that good is not a shared good, if that makes sense.
Well, you mentioned your work with the college age students who were had different theories, different sides, I'll say. So I'm not sure how you initiated dialogue between them, but if we were to carry that over to people who weren't in a study, how do you suggest that those conversations are initiated?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. So first, I'll just say that the research I did not initiate those conversations. I was just an observer. Many of them were initiated by faculty in Pennsylvania at the Penn Center for Civic Engagement, as well as colleagues across universities in the Philadelphia area. So I was not the initiator. I was just an observer, watching them and then interviewing people who participated. But in terms of how to initiate them in our own lives, it's hard. And I think it takes a lot of curiosity. So I think one important thing is that it's not something that everyone should feel like they have to do. In fact, it's not something that anyone should feel like they have to do. If the idea of having these conversations sounds terrible, it's okay to not have them, because I think that in order for them to be helpful, it's important to come into them really wanting to understand where someone who disagrees with you is coming from. And starting from that desire will go a long way. It's not something that anyone should force themselves to do in order to be a good citizen. There are lots and lots and lots of ways to be a good citizen. But if you want to understand, then I think having a practice of patience and waiting is important and helpful. So asking questions like, you know, you can open up a conversation. So what did you think of about a current event that just happened? What was your take on that? And if the person says something that you think is crazy or stupid or woefully misinformed, naive, harmful, you can breathe, you can feel your breath, you can count your breath, and then you can say, can you help me understand why you think that? Can you help me understand what that looks like for you? And the trick is to keep asking questions in a way that doesn't threaten somebody's dignity, in a way that helps them to ask questions of themselves. So you want to get a sense of what somebody might be afraid of, what the ideal society would look like to somebody. So you can ask somebody a question like, so what worries you about that? What concerns you about that? What would things look like ideally for you? How would society run in an ideal context? What would an elected official do ideally? What worries you about the way you see elected officials right now? What would you change if you could? To just try to get a sense of where their hopes and aspirations are and where their fears are. And what that can do is open up a space of questioning where over time the person might start feeling comfortable enough to question themselves. And that's what I found in the interviews that I did with people 3 years after their dialogue experience, is for many people, it just changed their orientation to the people on the other side. They just walked away feeling like those people were more decent than they expected. But for some people, particularly people who had been new to the political sphere, they started to question themselves after those conversations. So, for example, one woman who had voted for Trump in 2016 attended a dialogue event in 2017. When I interviewed her in 2020, she said, "Somebody at the dialogue asked me, 'If you say you believe this, then why did you vote like that?' And I've been asking myself that question ever since." And I interviewed her in October of 2020, and she still hadn't decided who she was going to vote for on November 3rd. And it was in part because those conversations had sparked questions for her, and it had been done in a way that allowed her to be comfortable enough to start questioning herself, had not made her defensive, had not made her afraid, but had made her curious about her own reasons and sparked a desire to have reasons that she could feel good about. And I saw that in quite a few people. So opening up a space where people can ask questions of each other and themselves is my suggestion.
So I'm listening to you pass this information along. And I had written down a question. Again, we're talking about constructive dialogue, specifically under the concept of political polarization, with Dr. Rachel Wall, who's a professor at UVA's School of Education. And I had a question about how you keep your mind on conversation with the individual you're speaking with versus educating or convincing. But what I'm hearing makes me think of pretend you're the therapist. It has this whole therapy concept of tell me how it felt for you. Tell me what you're thinking about that. Why did you do that? Am I making this too simple? Am I treating it too lightly?
I think that's a really good way to put it, because what I have seen is that laying a groundwork of interpersonal trust can be an important step toward having conversations that are more about the exchange of reasons. So it's not that we want to only have conversations that are therapeutic, as you put it. It's not that we want to only have conversations where we're trying to understand somebody's hopes and fears. It's that these can lay a groundwork that give us a reason to listen to the other person. So if we start out with argument, if we start out saying, "Here are all of the reasons that I'm right," we haven't really given the person a reason to listen, a reason to think that we have something worth listening to. But if we establish a path of mutual curiosity, of mutual interest, then that conversation can evolve into a direct attempt to persuade, because that person then has a reason to think that we have something worth saying because we've shown curiosity about them.
Again, our guest today is Dr. Rachel Wall. She's a professor at UVA School of Education and Human Development. As we talk about constructive dialogue under the umbrella of political polarization that you find in today's culture, let's take a break and we'll be right back. And thanks again for being here with us today, Sunday morning wake-up call. Dr. Rachel Wall here with us. So, Dr. Wall, once you have these conversations, and even if you're meeting with someone for the first time or whether you're meeting a family member for however long they've been in your life and you've had numerous conversations where you've been laying a constructive dialogue base. At what point, if ever, do you attempt to discuss some of the more difficult topics in today's world, maybe abortion, or if you have either or both people are avid political base followers, or do you just avoid these topics?
Well, I think that you can approach them from the very beginning. I think the question is more, at what point do you switch into a mode where you're directly trying to persuade someone else versus listening to them? So I think you could have a really early initial conversation about, say, abortion or, say, the January 6th incident at the Capitol, in which you're just saying, can you help me understand where you land on that? And what concerns do you have that brought you there? And what worries you? And what do you hope for? And then the question is, when do you switch to inviting them to see your point of view? The philosopher Tony Layden has a framework that I think is really helpful, where he says, rather than presenting our argument as if it is just plain rationally superior, which is pretty off-putting to anyone who disagrees with you, instead, we can present our arguments as if they're invitations. I'm inviting you to consider taking up my stance. I'm trying to make it appealing to you. I'm trying to offer you an invitation to see the world in this way. I'm not telling you that hands down, objectively, just a smarter, better way to see the world, because who wants to take that up? But if it's an invitation, like, would you consider trying this on? Then it opens up a little bit more space for possibility. Now, I think that there are many commitments that we're not going to be argued out of, but I do think there's a space in which we can come to see our ideals as being better realized in a different course of action. So, for example, the woman that I told you about a little bit ago, who had, like many of the students I interviewed, changed considerably over 3 years in her political opinions, she had a very deep commitment to the pro-life movement, was very deeply against abortion, and that had aligned her with conservative and Republican politics. And she, over the years, had come to see, both through conversation and through direct experiences, her commitment to life, her religious commitment to life, as also being importantly expressed through care for refugees and other immigrants. She had come to see the Trump administration's separation of babies and toddlers and other children from their parents at our borders as being anti-life, in a way that she saw abortion as being anti-life. And this raised a lot of questions for her about how to best express her religious commitment to life in her politics. So it wasn't that somebody argued her out of being pro-life. It was that through conversations and experiences, it became more complicated for her how to express in politics her commitment to life.
You've mentioned a couple times now the change over the 3 years. Do you expect that these are, I'll use the word, lasting/permanent changes? Are these issues that 3 years later can change again? Is this a stamp, like a tattoo, where this is what you have? or are these things that can be erased and rewritten?
Yeah, that's a good question. So first I'll say that I'm interested in that question too, and I might continue to follow these students for longer to find out empirically how to answer that question. But I would expect that it depends. I would expect that for some people, this is more fluid than for others. I think that we are in a political environment in which our political identities are less likely to encounter the kinds of shifts that these conversations open up the possibility of. So it makes it less likely that there will be a lot of fluidity over the years, because we tend to be in political bubbles, as we've been hearing about lots and lots, right? We don't have a lot of conversations with people who disagree with us. But I think that there are some people who are nonetheless always actively seeking and questioning and reconsidering. I don't think that that's going to look like a lot of dramatic back and forth between parties in this particular political environment, but it could look like periodic reevaluations of where we stand in regard to particular issues and how to best translate our ideals into action.
Again, our guest today, Professor Rachel Wall, UVA School of Education and Human Development, as we talk about political polarization and constructive dialogue. So, Professor, I'm going to ask a question here, and I'm not sure whether you have an answer that's based on an actual, from the actual work that you observed, or this is more from personal thoughts and research, but I hope we can get into this sort of start of a conversation. But if you have these sorts of constructive dialogue groups, and let's say you have two disparate sides, and I'll say that you have a strongly religious and an atheist group. Is that group more likely to have a better conversation than a group that is strongly religious but has noticeably different beliefs within their strongly religious group?
So are you asking, is it a better conversation when you have two clearly opposing sides, or is it a better conversation when there's a lot of different beliefs all heterogeneously combined together without two clear poles? Is that what you're asking?
Yes. I mean, for, I guess, a better example, to more put names on it, if you have Catholics versus atheists in the room to talk about religion versus Catholics who may be strongly old-style Catholics versus more relaxed Catholics who follow some of the more, they don't feel the need to go to church every day, but communion is important. And some of the other beliefs are good, and others are, I don't follow that. And you put the two groups of Catholics in the same room and let them argue or have constructive dialogue versus the Catholics and atheists who may argue or have constructive dialogue. Which room is more likely to come out with a better sense of understanding of each other?
an interesting question. I have not studied that, but if I were to guess, I would say that I would anticipate that the Catholics and atheists would likely approach each other with fewer expectations or less of an expectation that the other is going to agree with them or share any common ground, and a greater degree of curiosity, which I think, both of which I think could open up more space for curiosity, understanding, seeking, listening. Whereas I would think that if we go in with the expectation that we share a faith tradition, but we disagree on how to live that faith tradition, on one hand, it's easier because we share a basic premise about the world. But on the other hand, that basic shared set of premises about the world might make it harder, because it might be harder then to accept differences. If we all agree on X, Y, and Z, then why do you go in this other direction in terms of how you practice those commitments? It might be harder to accept differences than when we go into a conversation thinking, I probably don't have anything in common with this person, and I just want to understand how they can live with that worldview, where that came from. I think we might go in with a greater sense of openness and novelty. And I think novelty really helps these conversations. I've also observed conversations where students met for the entire semester each week, and there was kind of a point of diminishing returns, because I think the sense of novelty, of it being an extraordinary space where I'm understanding someone that I usually don't get to understand, can create a special sort of availability, personal availability, that feels unique. And I think if you go into a conversation with people who you expect to basically agree with you, but who just maybe aren't doing it the right way, there might not be that sense of a special chance to talk to people who you don't usually get to understand.
Does confirmation bias play a role in this? And for those who aren't familiar with the term, can you give a definition of confirmation bias?
Sure. I would say the simplest way to define that is finding what you expect to find. But maybe you could tell me what you mean by the question.
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of a social media and news aspect, where I know what I like in a political aspect, and so that seems to be all the news that pops up in my computer settings and my iPhone, and so I read more of that. And so when someone tries to tell me differently, I say, well, that's not true, because my news feeds disagree with that.
Yeah, so I definitely think that plays a role. But the tricky thing is that just being exposed to news and opinions on the other side seems not to help very much. Research has showed that people who read news from the other side of the political spectrum just tend to be better at coming up with reasons to disagree with it. And in fact, in one study, the more educated a person was, the better they were at coming up with reasons to disagree with the opposing news that they read. They weren't more open-minded about considering those other viewpoints. And I
really
think that is why, yeah. So I think that's why it's important to go beyond just forcing yourself to read other news media, although I do think it's really helpful to see how something is being presented as a way to understand how somebody could hold such an opposing view, right? So if you look at something like the voting legislation in Florida and, you know, wonder how anybody could agree with whatever the other side of the issue is from where you stand. And then you look at the way that voting legislation is being depicted, depending on the media that you're reading. You know, in one media, the voting legislation is being depicted as making elections more secure. And on the other side of the spectrum, that voting legislation is being depicted as reducing the number of people who are able to vote, who should, you know, creating restrictions on who can vote so that you're actually disenfranchising people who by law should be enfranchised. And I'm not saying that it's all a social construction and it neither are really true and it doesn't really, you know, they're equally untrue or equally true. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that reading the other side of the news won't necessarily convince you to think differently about that issue, but it can help you understand why somebody else would think differently about it. When you read the news that other person is reading, it can make that other person seem less crazy or mean or stupid when you understand how the issue is being framed in their media. On that note, I do think that what I think of as interpretive communities, so the ways that people around us are thinking and talking about an issue, the ways that our news media are thinking and talking about an issue, and also what we are given a reason to have imaginative empathy for. So what I mean by that is there are certain people's shoes that we're asked over and over again to imagine ourselves walking in. There are certain people's experiences that we're asked over and over again to imagine ourselves experiencing. Certain people's feelings that we're asked to imagine ourselves feeling. But who those people are really, really different depending on the news media and the conversations that we're exposed to. So it can seem as if people are just mean-spirited and don't care, but in fact, it's that they haven't been asked to use their emotional imagination to walk a mile in those people's shoes. They've been asked to use their emotional imagination to walk a mile in these other people's shoes. And that's one function of the news media, is who is it asking you to imagine the experience of? So the short answer is yes, I think that social media and other forms of media play a huge role in this, but I don't think that simply being exposed to media on the other side is going to change our views on political issues, although that's not necessarily its most important function.
Dr. Rachel Wall with us today, associate professor in the Department of Leadership, Foundations, and Policy at UVA School of Education and Human Development. Let's take a break. Be right back. And thank you again for being with us here on the Wren Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Dr. Rachel Wall here with us to talk about political polarization and constructive dialogue. Professor Wall, are some ages or backgrounds or genders more open to constructive dialogue than others?
So most of my research has been on university students, and I do think that they're at a particularly good point in their lives to have these conversations because they are trying to decide what kind of adults they want to be. The graduate students who attended the dialogue sessions were just as curious, just as committed, just as hopeful about how constructive these conversations could be, but the conversations had less of an impact on their long-term understanding. When I talked to the graduate students 3 years later, there were far fewer of them who talked about reevaluating how to express their commitments in politics as a result of the conversation, and far more undergraduates who talked about it in that way. So I do think that college, or not necessarily college, but being at that age, being in early adulthood, is an especially open time because people are exploring many different aspects of themselves.
I read the phrase in some of your work or something that you said called emotional temperature. Can you tell me more about that?
Sure. I think I used that to suggest that we can take our own emotional temperatures. A lot of people criticize dialogue because the implication seems to be that we should just be having nice, polite conversations about things that really warrant us screaming about, because there are deep and real injustices in our society that warrant a lot more than emotionless, neutral conversation. So what I don't mean is that we should evacuate emotion from our politics. Emotion is our way in to caring and commitment. You know, otherwise, why not just watch TV, right? But I think that emotion can have different effects in different modes of engagement. So dialogue should not take the place of emotionally expressive politics, like protest, like the energy it takes to put together a collective lawsuit, like boycotts, like strikes, like lots of different organizing work, like calling your elected officials to try to persuade them. All of that takes deep emotional energy. But I think that when we're in a conversation with somebody in which we're trying to lay the groundwork for understanding, we can take our emotional temperature in the sense of asking ourselves, am I able to have this kind of conversation about this topic? Would it be helpful? And do I want to? So there are conversations that it's topics about which it probably wouldn't be helpful or possible for me to have a purely understanding-oriented conversation with somebody because I feel so strongly about it that it feels irresponsible to just listen, even though I know that in the long run, listening can be what enables that other person to start questioning and opening up space of other possibilities in the long run. So on those topics, I might try to understand the other side by asking other people who have had those conversations what they learned, by reading perspectives that are longer than just the headlines on the other side, but more first-person accounts of how they can come to support another position. But I take my own emotional temperature to ask myself whether a conversation is one that I want to enter into, is helpful for me to enter into at that particular moment. And in a sense, it's a form of self-protection, because these conversations won't be beneficial to everyone all the time. Sometimes they just do require more emotional work than is worthwhile for the person, and that's okay. It's okay to not have these conversations.
So let me throw out something that's somewhat recent / current event and get your feedback on it. So former President Trump removed from all Twitter accounts for speaking out. House GOP Representative Liz Cheney, discussion about removing her from leadership position for speaking out. Both Republicans, and then a Republican voter could see those two issues in a different manner. If I were a Republican, I might say, hey, why did you take away President Trump's Twitter account? He was just speaking out. Hey, Liz Cheney, I don't care that she was speaking out. She's not with the rest of the GOP. Take away her opportunity to speak out. Or if I'm on the Democratic side, I would be completely opposite. And I would applaud President Trump having his opportunity to speak out through Twitter taken away. And I would be yelling or mocking the fact that the GOP was taking away Liz Cheney for just speaking out. So how is that discussed in a way, in a constructive manner?
Yeah, that's a really hard question, and it's a good question. First, I'll say that I think it's important to differentiate between conversations between people who are not public figures, who are not being offered a public platform to advance an agenda, but who are everyday people in a room that's not being publicized, trying to understand each other. That's a different kind of thing than a public figure who's being offered a public platform to advance a very specific agenda. I think that those are two separate processes that should be evaluated separately. One is people trying to figure something out, even trying to convince each other, but not wielding a public platform to do so. The other is using a public platform as a form of political power. Now, in terms of that second one, should everybody be able to wield all public platforms as a form of political power? I think it's a really hard question. And for me, it comes down to whether that platform is being used for purposes that are, in my mind, anti-democratic, in the sense of threatening violence against groups of people. Now, all of the argumentation will take place at that point around what is anti-democratic and whether somebody is actually threatening violence or inciting violence or encouraging violence. And I think that it's an important argument to have. What do we consider incitement to violence? What do we consider encouragement to violence, and why? And what do we consider democratic speech or anti-democratic speech? I don't think that anybody should be able to use a public platform to encourage violence. But I do think it's important to have a public debate about what it means to encourage violence and who is or isn't encouraging violence, and to have that be an open question that people debate and try to figure out.
So should we expect or hope that our leaders show the citizens or how constructive dialogue is to be done, or should it work the other way, where the citizens need to show the leaders what our expectations are?
Well, I think we could hope, but we might not be, we may not have our hopes fulfilled. I don't think that we can wait for our leaders to model these kinds of conversations. I think that we could look for leaders who do and support them. But I also think that we do, in addition, need visionary leaders who are skilled at rhetoric that dramatizes the moral stakes of justice. So I don't think that we should only look for leaders who are encouraging this kind of understanding-oriented conversation. I think that we need both in the political sphere. We need commitment to visions of justice, and we need curiosity about people who seem to oppose our view of justice. And we need leaders who can either do both of those or different kinds of leaders that can do those different things. But I'm not holding my breath for it.
Yeah, unfortunately. So we've got 5 to 6 minutes left, and which is probably not the time we need. But you had mentioned early in the program about some work that you had done and that you wanted, I believe you said, wanted to continue to do about police community relations. Can you talk for a bit about that? I'm curious police community relations is a deeper, more challenging conversation than some of the others when you talk about religion, is that that seems to be overall one topic, while police community relations, I envision race and politics and jobs and violence, etc.
It is a really different conversation when some people in the conversation have direct power over some other people in the conversation. So just to take it for a moment out of the police community example, anybody listening to this program right now could imagine having a dialogue with their boss, the people who could get them fired or who could directly fire them. That's a really different conversation than you would have with a group of strangers who have no control over your life. Then take that to the next level of people who actually have power over your life and death beyond just getting you fired from a job. And that's a completely different kind of conversation. So I think when you're talking about a conversation between police officers and communities, it is better for it to have a much more concrete set of aims and purposes and forms of accountability. So making it really clear for both police and community members what the conversation is meant to accomplish, how input is going to be considered and taken up, and what kind of follow-up community members and police officers should expect after the conversation in regard to what happened in the conversation. So rather than just this open-ended understanding, which I think is an important part of what should happen in those conversations, it can't be all of it, because what's at stake is relations of power, and for both police and community members, their lives being on the line in relation to each other. So it's a really different kind of conversation.
So do you start it the same way? Because you can't change the power aspect.
I would start it differently. I would start it from a really clear set of expectations about what the conversation is going to address, what the community could expect in terms of follow-up from the conversation, and when and in what form they'll receive that follow-up, so that nobody is sitting there wondering whether or not it's worth their time and whether or not there's going to be any change as a result. Because in those conversations, there is something very concrete at stake. And then I think once you've established those expectations, you can structure in time for that kind of understanding-oriented, what you called therapeutic, let me see if I can understand what you're afraid of, let me see if I can understand what you're hoping for, but really clearly as one step in a process that is ultimately getting to what are the issues that we want to see changed and what are the processes that are going to react to this conversation, take up the suggestions from this conversation, and follow up with us after this conversation. So the understanding orientation could be a part of a much more structured, concrete process.
Again, our guest today is Professor Rachel Wall from UVA's Department of Education. Professor, you've got 30 seconds left. I'd like to know if you see things being any different in terms of political polarization, we'll say within the decade.
I don't know. That's how I'll use my 30 seconds.
That is a fair answer, because I think that's the answer that the majority of listeners would also give. Okay. I guess that means we invite you back in the future to see things where they stand. I hope you'll take us up on that offer. Again, our guest today, as we talked about constructive dialogue and political polarization, Dr. Rachel Wall, Associate Professor at UVA School of Education and Human Development. Next week, we'll be talking with folks from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library about summer reading suggestions. Join us again next week. Thanks, everybody.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake-Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.